to Day On Against the Grain. What does May 1st mean for workers and worker struggles? What principles underlie the anarchist and socialist outlooks associated with May Day? I'm CS. You'll hear a range of voices and perspectives on radical history, theory, and practice coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Whatever you choose to call it, International Workers' Day, International Labor Day, or simply May Day, May 1st marks a day of resistance, workers' resistance to, and victory in the face of, hardships imposed on them by employers, by capitalists. Today we approach May Day from a number of angles, historical, ideological, practical, and theoretical. We'll draw on conversations old and new, showcasing a number of interviews conducted over the course of Against the Grain's 20 years of existence, including previously unaired portions of a recent conversation about an effort to organize delivery workers in the gig economy. We begin with historical insights into the event that May Day commemorates, that event, or set of events, occurring in 1886 in Chicago. On May 1st, 2007, I spoke with Nicholas Lampert, an historian, writer, and artist who currently teaches at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
So on May 1st, 1886, over 80,000 people marched in Chicago as part of a national strike for, among other things, the 8-hour workday. What was the political context, the labor and class context for this national strike?
Well, as you mentioned, I mean, there was 8-hour strikes happening in Chicago, but all over the country as well. So it was a movement for the 8-hour day, but also it was somewhat divided because you had more mainstream labor people advocating for, you know, changes within the system. But also Chicago was the epicenter of the anarchist movement, so you had a lot of people advocating for, you know, basically replacing capitalism with a more collectively based society. And also Chicago, the majority of its population were recent immigrants. So, yeah, just, you know, an unbelievable amount of people there working in factories. If you think of, you know, Uptown Sinclair's The Jungle, that was very much the climate of people working in these huge factories for low pay. But then, of course, you had, you know, people fighting against it. So in 1886, there was this, you know, groundswell movement. There was this, you know, movement for eight-hour day, movements against capitalism, and that's what was happening leading up to the events at Haymarket.
So on that day, this is May 1st, I believe, four strikers were killed during skirmishes at something called the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company. That's on the south side of Chicago. In response, a mass rally was called for May 4th at Haymarket Square in Chicago, where radicals like Albert Parsons, who was editor of the largest anarchist newspaper in the U.S. at the time, The Alarm, spoke to a crowd of around 3,000 people. The event was winding down. It was the evening. And what did the police decide to do?
Well, just to clarify, on May 1st, there was marches for the 8-hour day. There was 80,000 people who marched throughout the streets of Chicago. But it was on May 3rd,
that
there was a police shooting of workers, because while you had these people marching, there was also strikes happening all over the city, because this movement, the 8-hour day movement, had made enough significant gains where it looked like the owners of industry were going to cave into these demands. And so you also had these factories where people were on strike, and you had replacement scabs going into the factory, and obviously the workers who were out on the streets were fighting against them and protesting against them. But as you mentioned, on the south side of the city on May 3rd, there was a skirmish, and basically the company brought in a militia who opened fire on the workers. Three workers were killed. Many of the anarchist organizers in Chicago called for a rally on May 4th. And that's the date where, obviously, much of the world knows what happens with the Haymarket tragedy in Haymarket Square. And there was a rally, I'd say, about 3,000 people. It was, from all accounts, a very peaceful rally that happened that night. The mayor showed up and basically said, this is just a rally with people speaking. Basically, the police could go home. But a police chief took it on his own accord to march right into the center of the rally, and that's when a bomb was thrown from the crowd, landed right in the middle of the police, and that's where a lot of disputes on what happened and who actually threw the bomb.
Well, who might have thrown the bomb, in your opinion?
Well, it's really difficult to say, and I don't think historians have ever resolved it. A lot of people think perhaps it was an agent provocateur, that meaning that it was someone from the police or the private detectives, the Pinkertons, who threw a bomb into the crowd to create, obviously, a great amount of chaos, and would be used as an excuse to go after the labor movement, and kind of the excuse to really shut down the labor movement, which, of course, is what happened. But a lot of historians, probably one of the most famous anarchist historians, Paul Avrich, who wrote the book The Haymarket Tragedy, he actually thinks it was an anarchist who threw the bomb. He thinks it was someone who was kind of working outside the circle of the movement and someone who acted independently. But no one really knows to this day. There's absolutely no one knows. But what people do know is that a lot of the labor leaders who were rounded up, put on trial, and executed weren't even present at that rally. So it did seem to be very much a witch hunt, and it was used to really shut down the labor movement at the time.
So what happened to the eight men who were put on trial?
Well, from all accounts, it was really, a kangaroo court. You had the main newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, which the owner actually owned the factory where the skirmishes happened the day before on May 3rd. You had that owner owning the newspaper as well. So there was this, it was basically that these folks were not going to get a fair trial whatsoever. And so three people were sentenced to death. Another person who was on trial hung himself, and three other people were given life sentences. And, of course, this court case captured the world attention. The court case when these people were sentenced to death was November 11th of the following year, and the whole world was very carefully watching this. I mean, this was a major international affair, and, the world watched in horror as these people were put to the gallows, and it was, a major, major news event. And they of course, became martyrs to labor cause, and there's been debates on how to remember and celebrate these people from all different sides of the political spectrum.
That was Nicholas Lampert, artist, historian, and author of A People's Art History of the United States. For more insights into the history of May Day, we turn to a conversation I had with Paul Buell, a former lecturer in history and American civilization at Brown University. Paul has authored or edited more than three dozen books on radical history, labor, popular culture, and comic art. When Paul Buell joined this program on May 1st, 2006, he had this to say about May Day's origins.
It's fascinating because the United States is so frequently seen as a conservative place in terms of labor and socialist movements and communist movements and so forth. And in some ways it has been as the center of the global empire. But May Day really begins on the streets of Chicago in 1886 around the Haymarket tragedy. And in a sense, it was as much the martyrdom of those social revolutionaries, or anarchists as we could call them, as the struggle of hundreds of thousands of American workers, largely immigrants from Central Europe, to demand an eight-hour day. It was the climax of an eight-hour movement that had been going on for several years, and Chicago was so revolutionary then it was called Little Paris. Well, the International adopted May Day in several years later, in 1889, and it became an international workers' holiday, which is a sort of a paradox because it was also in the United States where Labor Day was first seen and almost immediately posed against May Day. As instead the holiday of the white skilled worker in the American Federation of Labor who wanted to see just as little of non-whites, women, and more recent immigrants as possible.
Interesting. So Labor Day, which we celebrate, of course, in September each year, was the product of a more conservative labor energy?
Most definitely. And it was seen as the holiday which would be acceptable to employers. It was sort of like the grand picnic day at the end of the summer months. Whereas May Day had associations going back to, some people say, Neolithic times, the moment of flowers and greenery bursting forth, sexual energy, which has always been related to May Day, May poles in Britain, and all kinds of other things which linked to anarchist and socialist movements and were inherently, one might say, more explosive and more uncontrollable.
In terms of Labor Day, May Day in the U.S. over the years, has there been much militancy around this day?
There have been different patterns that emerged in different epochs, and for the most part, the most energetic May Day activists have been immigrants over the generations. They were Italians and others, Jews and others in the 1910s in the IWW and in the Socialist Party and so forth, who had a one might call a European or internationalist sense of May Day, and they were eager to go out and celebrate. By the 1920s and 1930s, the Communist Party and its milieu had a certain hegemony, and May Day, especially in New York, was a grand occasion and remained so really until the Cold War crushed it down. But May Day was also the opening gun, so to speak, for a summer season of radical activities. And in many parts of the country, it was led within several weeks to the beginnings of summer camps where there were choruses, children's camps, radical singers, folk singers and others would sing during the summer, and left-wingers would enjoy themselves out of the hot industrial cities for a few days at a time and have little sort of radical circles in which they would rebuild their energy for the approaching fall. So May Day was a time to celebrate. It was also a time to think of the wonderful left-wing picnics that were ahead, and to rest and recuperate from the winter and contemplate a really good social and cultural time, as well as a time of political learning.
The labor historian and radical comic book creator Paul Buell. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You heard Paul mention the all-important links between May Day and anarchist and socialist movements. But what is anarchism? How should it be understood? In July 2004, Cindy Milstein joined this program to share their understanding of anarchist thought. Cindy is an anarchist, activist, and writer. Their books include Anarchism and Its Aspirations and There Is Nothing So Whole as a Broken Heart, Mending the World as Jewish Anarchists. I asked Cindy Milstein to lay out the basic principles of anarchism, principles that bind together anarchism's various strands.
What I think is sort of at the heart of anarchism, both historically, it emerged out of sort of the 1840s, 1860s, 1880s as part of a large socialist movement that was responding to things like the Industrial Revolution. But over time to its present day, what really sort of anarchists tend to share is sort of first and foremost an ethical outlook on the world. It ultimately is sort of an ethical political philosophy. And by that I mean that anarchists tend to constantly look at institutions, structures, relationships, social formations skeptically to understand what forms of hierarchy or domination are sort of eminent within them, and also simultaneously ask the question of how could we structure these same things in ways that would allow for more individual and social freedom simultaneously. So the project of anarchism is often to ask as the first question is this the right way to do things? And if not, what would be the right way? The right way meaning what would allow for the balance between a free individual or a free, fully individuated self and a free society or a fully individuated society, and that both those two are intimately related to each other. So that generally binds together all anarchists is sort of it's a project in terms of pushing out what freedom can be, and that that's going to be a never-ending project. It's not something that we'll attain at one moment and forever it'll be perfect, but that's going to be a constant struggle.
You mentioned domination, and certainly people on the left have heard of things like and struggled against class-based domination, gender-based mm-hmm. domination, race-based domination. There are all kinds of oppressions out there that people are mobilized against. What is the anarchist take on domination that might differ from what might be considered some of the socialist and feminist aspects or analysis of domination?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there's overlaps. Anarchism historically came out of socialism, and a lot of anarchists, including myself, understand ourselves as part of the larger sort of socialist project. But where anarchists ended up critiquing socialism specifically was in areas, for instance, of how we would envision moving from the present moment to greater forms of freedom. And anarchists have always thought that both that means that you have to look at pretty much every area of life. You can't just focus on economics or just the personal realm or just the political realm or, you know, just race, just gender, just class, that all those things are interrelated. They're distinct yet interrelated. And you need to sort of understand how different forms of domination exist in those different areas, but yet there's also some similarities and systematic forms that overlap with them. But the other difference is that anarchism has always tried to, doesn't mean we all succeed, but anarchists have generally tried to figure out how can we in this moment as much as possible practice and or illustrate ways of what we want freedom to look like in the longer term for more people. So how we do things now has to have an intimate relationship to the better society we see emerging over time. In other words, anarchists have sort of been critical of this idea of someday in the future after a revolution or, you know, after a social struggle or after we go through sort of a, you know, a worker state or some other form, we'll get to the point where we start beginning to figure out what freedom is, or we'll know what it is at that point. And anarchists have sort of said, no, you know, it's the process of doing the projects we want to get to freedom is freedom. that isn't a means to an end, it is part of the end. So the real intimate relationship between the means and the ends, they aren't necessarily the same, but how we figure out how to do things in the future matters. So the big emphasis in why anarchism, I think, has become so strong within the anti-capitalist movement and really has defined the anti-capitalist movement right now is that anarchists have said, no, how we organize the demonstrations has to be extremely participatory, directly democratic. Everybody has to have, you know, a feeling of inclusion and say that we have to allow for diversity to flourish, that we have to, you know, be sensitive to the different forms of domination. And again, we're not always good at doing these things the right way, but anarchists are committed to at least practicing how to try to do them in the right ways in mm-hmm. the process of doing the things we do.
Yeah, if domination and hierarchy are anathema to anarchists, I wonder, well, I mean, I guess that answers my question, but if you could elaborate, are you saying then that no hierarchy can ever be a positive thing, that a top-down structure could never be productive or helpful or lead to a society that could be happy and fulfilled?
I think generally, by and large, anarchists feel that, you know, what you want to seek out is a society where those that are affected by things get to have decision-making over those things, and not just the final decision, but figuring out what the questions are, how we'll discuss them, how we'll debate them, that in a sense there's a real emphasis on the dialogue that happens to come up with the solutions we want, social solutions we want as a society, and that it has to take into account solidarity both in communities and across communities, a sense of mutualism toward each other. You know, generally anarchists are extremely suspect of anything that tends toward the vertical in terms of social organization instead of the horizontal. So, for instance, I generally feel as an anarchist that you can't necessarily get rid of power and you don't necessarily want to. The point is, what kinds of power? Are we talking about the power of a few to control the many for ends such as wealth, prestige, simply the ability to control people or hate? Or are we talking about a power to creatively, imaginatively, you know, collectively intervene in our lives and our communities in ways to allow for instance, everybody to have food or everybody to be able to fulfill themselves through education or art or all the multiple other ways we want to figure out who we are as human beings, and that to really ever have a society where all of us feel part of it, intimately part of it, both personally and as a member of a community, then we all have to be able to actually make those decisions. I think this is a moment equivalent to sort of the Industrial Revolution, where there's a tremendous shift going on in what's happening, specifically with capitalism, which probably at the moment is the most worrisome source of social domination, just because it has basically ended up, I mean, Marx's brilliant analysis that capitalism needs to continually grow or it will die becomes more clear every day in terms of how capitalism is basically spread to every corner of the world, but also into our bodies through the commodification of sort of our DNA. So on all levels, there's more and more of areas where sort of capitalism reaches, and that in a sense right now, those of us that really want to see a world where all of us get to, you know, have a say in creating a world that is really concerned about the bulk of humanity versus the small people in power, that we need to figure out ways in this moment to really contest how power is happening. So not just do things alongside it that can coexist with it, but do things that really contest where people make decisions in society.
The queer Jewish anarchist, activist, and author Cindy Milstein. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Worker struggles of the kind commemorated by May Day have, many of them have, been informed by Marxist analysis. Part of what Karl Marx understood as the plight of workers in a capitalist system is something called alienation, which leaves workers feeling unhappy and unfulfilled. So what is alienation, and what would freedom from alienation look like? In August 2012, Richard Lichtman joined me in studio. Lichtman was a radical philosopher and professor emeritus of psychology at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. His books include The Production of Desire, a detailed analysis of the works of Marx and Freud, and Essays in Critical Social Theory. To set the stage for what you're about to hear, Marx wrote about alienation in his Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts of 1844, and you'll hear Lichtman refer to Smith and Ricardo, by which he means Adam Smith and David Ricardo, two thinkers revered by mainstream economists. Richard began with these comments about the phenomenon of alienation.
In simple terms, you might say it's a process that's initiated by individuals who then lose control of the process, which turns against them. And I always like to go back to Fantasia and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, for those who remember, they're Disney. And in that sequence, as you know, Mickey Mouse initiates the process by which the broom basically becomes alienated from him, or he from the broom, because then it develops a kind of will of its own. But he has to initiate it. The broom doesn't get up on its own and begin moving the water around on the boat.
So according to Karl Marx, the worker under capitalism is alienated in a number of respects. And one of the most basic forms of alienation is the worker's alienation from the product he produces, the product he participates in producing. What does alienation mean in that context?
The worker is alienated from the product in an absolutely straightforward, commonsensical way. We learn that when we work in a factory, for example, we don't take home the object that we've made. So there's this implicit knowledge, and this knowledge indicates to you that the object does not belong to you, it belongs to the owner of the factory. You've done the work, however. He may have set out the plans, but he may have hired somebody, as a matter of fact, to plan the commodity, and nevertheless, it's your labor that's gone into it, but you don't own the thing that you've made. So it's a good starting point for Marx, because he wants to argue that we have initiated a process. The owner of the factory could not make these commodities on his own, and that gets truer as the economy gets more complicated. But he owns them. There's this kind of division between who makes the thing and who owns the thing. So the object is separated from us, and we're alienated from the object. We've made it. It's got our stamp on it, but we've lost control of it.
You once wrote this about alienation under Marx. Alienation is a process in which man embodies himself in the world and his embodiment tries to destroy him. Now, by embodiment, are we talking at least partly about the product of his labor And if so, in what sense is the product of his labor as the embodiment of the worker trying to destroy the worker?
Well, we have to be careful here. The object is not in any literal sense trying to destroy the worker, because the object is not the kind of being that has purpose, intention, consciousness, and so on. Now, the idea that the object is attempting to destroy us is a kind of illusion, but it's an illusion that is produced socially within capitalism. This is something that is part of the consciousness that accompanies or is ingredient in, would be a better word, ingredient in capitalism. And how does that come about? Well, we've made this object so it has some of our intention and purpose embodied in it. In other words, if I'm on the assembly line and my job is to polish an object that comes by me, the polished form of the object is due to my labor. I've supplied the activity and the skill and the knowledge and the imagination to know how to polish that object when it comes by. So it has my labor, and you'll often hear laborers, especially in the 30s and 40s, in popular songs, "Brother, can you spare a dime?" Once I built a building. The building is the work of the worker who sees himself in the building. So in the nature of labor, we get the fact that human beings are manifesting themselves in the object, and the object mirrors back to them, in some sense, what they were doing through the activity that produced the object. So it has a certain kind of human aspect to it, although it didn't get it on its own. The metal didn't produce its own polishing, right? The human being who worked on it did. But then that human being loses control over the further process of the whole thing. And whether people want to buy polished metal or not is no longer in his control.
Richard Lichtman went on to talk more about the phenomenon of objects gaining power over workers.
The object, or objects in general, are some things that are needed by workers in order to live. They have to have a certain accumulated food, shelter, and clothing if they're going to survive. That food, shelter, and clothing is produced by other workers, or by themselves in some cases. But it may not be sufficient for their livelihood. The object, in other words, may get a terrible power over them by the fact that they don't have enough money to purchase it. They've made it, and they have made it perhaps very well, but that doesn't accrue to their own well-being, because, as we said, the object belongs to the capitalist, not to the worker, and the capitalist is trying to reduce his costs as much as possible, because the lower the cost, the greater the amount of profit that he makes. So consequently, he's not inclined to give any more back to the worker, especially in Marx's early theory. He's not inclined to give anything more back to the worker than the worker needs in order to survive. So he says, this fact simply implies that the object produced by labor, its product, now stands opposed to it as an alien being, as a power independent of the producer. The product of labor is labor which has been embodied in an object and turned into a physical thing. That's clear enough. This product is an objectification of labor. The performance of work is, at the same time, its objectification. The performance of work appears in the sphere of political economy as a vitiation of the worker. Why is that? Because the worker is not respected as a creative human being. He has to follow whatever the prescriptions of the capitalist are. If in 1840 he had to work 10, 12, 14 hours a day, that's what was required of him. If that exhausted him and destroyed him, that was unfortunate for him. That's what the capitalist demanded. And you can always go back and read Dickens to see how children were working for the length of time that they were working. You don't even need to go through Marx for that point. Dickens was much impressed or depressed by the fact that he saw what labor did to human beings. So the worker is exhausted by the work. The worker gets nothing vital out of the work. He's not gratified by the work as a human being. He produces these objects, and they belong to someone other than himself.
Marx also says the worker is alienated from the ability to work. Tell us about that.
Well, he's alienated. I'm saying he because most of the workers were he at that time. It doesn't matter whether it's he or she. The workers are alienated from the object because they are simultaneously alienated from the activity of producing the object. If they controlled the process of producing the object, if they controlled it, it would have to be because they had power over the whole process of industrialization, which they don't have. So it follows that if they're going to lose the capacity to control the object, they're simultaneously going to be denied control over the process by which the object is produced. And they're going to lose control over the nature of the work system itself. So if the assembly line is moving very rapidly and people are being harmed by the nature of accidents that are occurring in this process, they may want to slow down the assembly line, but the capitalist will not permit it because he wants to turn out as many objects as possible. So the worker doesn't have control over the labor process. That makes some sense. Okay, so what happens now? The worker has lost control over the object and over the process. But I think there's another nuance in your question that's important. The worker also loses control over the very possibility of working, because when the system is in decline, the worker can't even establish that he has the right to work. He doesn't get the capacity to work at all, let alone control the process once he's in it. He doesn't necessarily have an opportunity to get into it. It's not his issue any longer as to whether there's going to be labor available or not. So that great want, as Marx says, the most basic of all, is something out of his control. He can't control whether there's going to be work available for him or not. By the way, Marx keeps making a point over and over again that capitalism forces the workers into regarding themselves and their own capacity and their own skills essentially for the sake of survival. In a humane socialist society, workers would be able to produce for the sake of realizing their full human being as human beings. But they don't have that opportunity in this society. They work in order to survive, essentially, and everything that contributes to their survival is beneficial. Everything that acts against their survival is seen as dubious until we know exactly what kind of consequence they're attempting. Marx's view of labor is it's only in a period of scarcity that labor is for the sake of survival. Ultimately, labor is for the sake of realizing the nature of the human being who is laboring. Labor is an opportunity, not just a form of unhappy compulsory activity. It is that so long as we have minimal development in our means of production. But as we develop those means of production, which in a rational society we would, they will be more available for more people to be able to look at their own labor through the guise of, does it fulfill me as a human being? Not does it make it possible for me not to starve? Because that's the negative view, which says labor is good if it keeps me alive. Well, yes, to a certain extent, that's certainly true. On the other hand, what do we want labor to be beyond the fact that it keeps us alive? We want the labor to realize and fulfill the capacities of what it is to be human, which is why Marx says at the end of the Grundrisse, the ultimate freedom of the individual only begins when the necessity for work is in fact over. In other words, it looks like it's an appeal for a certain kind of automation in the economic system. When people are not required to labor and put all their effort and energy and skill and imagination into making things simply to stay alive, when they can produce for the sake of producing a beautiful city or for making art or science or literature and so on, that's when the actual fulfillment of human being has an opportunity to flourish.
That's Richard Lichtman, the late great philosopher, author, and Wright Institute-based scholar. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. We move from theory back to practice because May Day is fundamentally about practice, about the collective activity of workers pushing back against capitalist exploitation. Recently, we presented an interview with Paul Gray about an effort to organize gig workers, specifically food couriers in Toronto. We didn't have a chance to present a chunk of that conversation about the process of identifying issues important to workers in a given workplace and about the importance of building democratic structures over the course of an organizing campaign. So we turn now to previously unaired remarks by Paul Gray, Assistant Professor of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Canada. An important traditional workplace organizing method is issue identification. Foodsters United, a group of couriers working for the platform company Foodora in Toronto, who conducted a workplace organizing campaign, realized they needed to identify and foreground an issue of concern to workers and a worker demand that inspired widespread enthusiasm. I asked whether the issue to focus on is necessarily the most egregious thing that an employer is doing to its workers.
This is what people often think when they first start organizing. They think that the right issue is the most egregious thing that the employer is doing or the most illegal. And sometimes that's the issue, but actually this is not what makes a good issue. Traditionally, the right issue to focus on is the one that is widely felt, deeply felt, and relatively winnable. It's widely felt because the vast majority of the workers have this as one of their main issues, and so it's a way to bring as many people as possible into a majority participation campaign. It's deeply felt. It's something that upsets people enough that they're sufficiently agitated about that they are willing to make a commitment and take certain risks in order to address this particular issue. And it has to be relatively winnable in the sense that if you've identified through your education who's to blame for it, is it something that that person or that group can actually address and fix? And it's especially important that you choose something that is relatively winnable early on when you have a campaign comprised of people who don't have a lot of experience with labor organizing. Even if you get a small victory, it is a victory nonetheless. It gives people some courage and confidence to try to win more. And so it's important to choose something whereby some collective activity can achieve it to show folks what is possible. And then from there, you build to ever bigger victories on the strength of that early achievement that you've made. And so, you know, there were a variety of issues that these folks had. One issue is people being upset about how they were being treated by the dispatchers, but it wasn't widely felt. Some people felt that way. Others kind of liked that Foodora had dispatchers rather than just the sheer impersonality of algorithmic control you get with Uber Eats. Many people had as their issue the tipping system in Foodora, which was very cumbersome, but it was an annoyance. It wasn't something that was deeply felt. Another issue was just transit and transportation infrastructure in Toronto is quite bad, and it contributes to the hardships of this kind of work. But that's not something that's relatively winnable. It's not something that Foodora could really fix. It's so much broader than that. And so the issue that they settled on is something called auto compensation. They thought that this met the criteria of a good issue. Written in the contract between these food couriers and Foodora was something called automatic compensation. If these couriers had to wait more than 20 minutes at a restaurant for the food that they were to deliver because the restaurant was late for some reason, then they were supposed to be compensated with $5 in addition to the wage that they made for that particular delivery. But in order to be eligible for that, they had to go through this cumbersome process where they manually had to apply for it and then be given it by the company. That was one aspect of the issue. Another aspect of it was that Fedora was not telling new hires about this, so they weren't even aware that this was part of the fine print of the contract. And so the couriers had as their demand the idea that this would become automatic, that this compensation, if they had to wait 20 minutes in a restaurant, there would be a timer connected to the technology of the app, and that they would automatically receive this compensation that had been promised to them anyway in the contract, and they wouldn't have to go through the manual cumbersome process of applying for it, even if they weren't told about it by Fedora, new couriers would receive it. And on the strength of this issue, they engaged in a new wave of organizing, and they developed a petition that they were going to then deliver in a kind of march on the boss action to the general manager of Fedora, demanding this issue. And the reason it was a good issue for them is that it was widely felt. Everyone who knew about it cared about it, and anyone who didn't know about it, this was an effective way to have organizing conversations and engage in agitation, and they cared about it once they did find out about it. It's something that upset them, especially because it was already in the contract and they found out that they had been deprived of this. And it was something that was relatively winnable. It was something that a small change in the code, it could be rectified by Fedora. And so this was one of the major issues that they identified that they were going to engage in a huge petition campaign for.
Was their demand on this issue met by Fedora?
Well, they were on their way, I think, to having a fairly successful petition campaign. They got 500 signatures after 2 weeks of organizing. And this wasn't an online petition. It was a petition that had to be signed in person by pen. And the reason for that is because they wanted to be able to engage in the one-on-one in-person conversations with folks, especially after this hiring spree. You know, they wanted to reach out to a bunch of the people with whom they had never had these organizing conversations with before. So I think they were on their way to a successful petition campaign, and I think they would have had a lot of leverage to try to win this small victory. But this, like so many other things, was interrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic. And the Foodsters United, like so many other people, went into a kind of crisis mode, and they had to shelve the petition and that demand.
So, Paul, it's evident that a lot of decisions had to be made by Foodsters United, by these couriers who were trying to unionize. All sorts of twists and turns, all sorts of challenges they had to overcome, strategies to come up with and implement. Issues of timing and intensity and, you know, what people could really manage to do given that they were working and trying to make a living at the same time. And there was certainly a commitment to democratic practice, to democratic decision-making, and that requires structures. And those structures might be easier to create and maintain in a centralized workplace, but we have, as you've been repeatedly saying, a very large and decentralized workplace. So what effort did Foodsters United make to establish a democratic decision-making structures, and how successful were they?
I think this is one of the major difficulties for labor organizing in the context of the gig economy. When you think about it, workers who are trying to unionize, they'll try to keep their union campaign secret from their employer for as long as possible, so that their employer can't engage in many of the union substitution, union suppression practices that employers often do when they find out that there's a union drive going on. And what workers would like to do is they'd like to try to get as many of the cards signed, and perhaps all of the cards signed, that they need prior to going public and applying to be recognized as a union to the labor board. This is much more difficult in the context of the gig economy because it's very difficult to know who all of your coworkers are. And so often gig workers, if they even try this, will have to go public much earlier because part of going public is, it's part of a necessary strategy to promote the fact that there's a union campaign to try to bring more of their coworkers into the process to try to find out who they are. And that raises some difficulties because it lengthens the amount of time that the employer can try to engage in various anti-union techniques while you're engaging in this union campaign. One of the issues it raises for gig workers is if you anticipate a relatively lengthy time during a union drive before you actually successfully form a union and the democratic structures which are required by law with the union, you have to ask, okay, what are the structures going to be in the interim period? And one of the things that Foodsters United tried to do was to develop what they called, the union before the union. They wanted to treat the union drive as a kind of union, as a kind of structure, as something democratic that, supportive couriers could plug into and participate in. And so they had a kind of steward structure. They had some committees. They also started to host general members meetings. Anyone who was a courier who was supportive of the effort was invited to these GMMs to be able to participate in and vote on the various decisions made by the campaign. But there was also another group. It's often referred to as the inside committee or the group of core organizers, the people who are committed to forming a union and who are doing the day-to-day organizing, strategizing, and decision-making. And this group was in parallel with the general members' meetings. The idea was to try to shift the decision-making power from this kind of inside committee, this group of core organizers, to the general members' meetings. But in this context, there's a number of decisions that you have to make that you have to keep secret from your employer, because if the employer finds out about them, it could undermine the campaign. You have to protect certain information, for example, things like the social maps and the charts, especially the list of union supporters. You have to keep that safe and make sure that only trusted people can gain access to that. So these kinds of decisions, the ones where there were some security concerns, were supposed to be kept within this kind of inside committee. But all the other decisions were supposed to shift to the GMMs. But that wasn't happening. There were some key strategic decisions being made that didn't have these security concerns being made within this inside committee. And often what happened was, these folks were making key decisions and then presenting them to the GMMs to be discussed and voted on by all of these other supportive couriers who weren't in the core organizing group. And there emerged some disagreements and debates about what the most democratic structure would be. Some folks thought that they should try to dissolve this kind of inside committee into the general membership meetings and reconstitute a smaller committee that was dedicated specifically to just security-related decisions and keeping key information secure. Others thought that they should maintain the inside committee and try to bring as many people from the GMMs into it to try to expand it. They tried both at various times, and neither really expanded the group of people making these key decisions within this kind of inside committee. And yeah, there were a lot of disagreements about that. I think that one of the considerations people have when they're starting to develop a campaign, including a union campaign, they don't want to create too many structures at the beginning because they're trying to organize a broader constituency, and they're worried that if they create all the structures beforehand, if they have various positions, even elected positions beforehand, People who weren't there from the beginning won't identify with the structure, with the organization, because they had no part in creating that structure or participating in those initial decisions about various roles, elected leadership positions, and the like. The issue is that if you defer creating those kinds of structures, then in the context of a union drive, when the employer is aware of your activities, engaging in a bunch of counterattacks to the union drive, when there's the pressures of being able to fulfill various phases of the union drive leading up to applying to form a union at the labor board, you know, a lot of issues, activities, decisions intervene such that the big structural questions tend to get deferred. And that can lead to a lot of informal power being held by some individuals. It can lead to a lack of accountability around how some decisions get made. And so I think one of the lessons to draw from the experience of Foosters United is you should try to establish those structures, those positions early on, and ensure that you have procedures by which those structures can be changed. And so as you're bringing more and more people into the campaign, even if they weren't there from the beginning, even if they didn't have a hand in initially forming those structures, if they know that there are procedures in place where all of the current members could adapt them and change them if the majority sought fit to do so, that gives people an identification with this organization, with these structures, even if they weren't there from the beginning. This, I think, is something that can be drawn from this experience, and generally, whatever their disagreements about the campaign and how it unfolded, most people active in the campaign thought that they should have implemented some of these structures, some of these procedures, had formal elections much earlier than they actually did.
Paul Gray teaches in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. We were discussing an article Paul wrote called "The Same Tools Work Everywhere: Organizing Gig Workers with Foodsters United." The article appeared in the journal Labor/Le Travail. That concludes today's tribute of a sort to May Day. I'm CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.